Well, greetings, everyone, and welcome to a really special online event today called Discovering the Sufi Way of the Beloved, Ecstasy and Surrender Through the Mystical Teachings of Islam. My name is Stephen Dinan, and I'm the founder and CEO of the Shift Network, and I'm really thrilled to be here today, and sobered as well, because we're in a moment when so much of the world is reeling from what happened in Orlando, and there's a great propensity to create more polarization with the world of Islam. And so I feel it's so important today that we have a chance to learn about the mystical core and the sacred heart and ecstasy and real love of the Sufi path, which is, I think, really part of bridging our sacred religious traditions and reunifying the human family. And there's really no one that I can imagine who's more perfect to introduce us into this path and to initiate us into the depths of it than Andrew Harvey. He is one of the most popular Shift Network faculty. We've had over 44,000 people attend one of his online events in the last year, and over 1,900 people have studied with him in in-depth programs. And he's really he's been a scholar mystic of many different world traditions and shown the ecstatic sacred core that links them together. And he's particularly been adept at bringing alive the Sufi path for a Western audience. Or, you know, I personally took a course on the Way of Passion with him many years ago, which was a very profound initiation into this lineage. And I just find myself so blessed and honored by the words and by the insights into this path as a path of love. So we're going to have an hour here with Andrew today, and then we'll also have a chance to go much deeper with him in an upcoming groundbreaking program called The Sufi Way of the Beloved. So we'll hear more about that towards the end. But for now, let's welcome Andrew.
Thank you so much, Stephen. I'm absolutely thrilled and honored to be able to present at last, because this has taken me a long time to find the courage actually to stand up and speak about this revelation of the path of the beloved and the path to the beloved that lies at the heart of Sufism. Islam has a mystical system and a mystical vision of such depth and such passion and such richness and such deep, profound wisdom, and it's agonizing to me to see the ways and to feel the ways that Islam is being caricatured, both by the terrorists and by Western commentators who simply do not know anything about the magnificence of the tradition that is in the Islamic mystical tradition. So to be able to present this is something that really thrills me and something that I feel very honored to do.
Well, let's enter in with a little bit of your own history. So I know you were raised more as a Christian in India and spent a lot of time turning to the East, but what was it that it really opened up the world of Sufism for you, and what was different about it when you encountered it than the other lineages that you've been exposed to?
Well, I was, as you know, born in India, and that's in fact where I met Sufism, because as you know, India has 100 million Muslims, and one of them was my driver as a child, an amazing man called Abdul, who was very thin and very intense, and would stop the car in the middle of traffic and get out and put his carpet down and pray. I was so moved by his adoration of God, and I was so moved by what he told me about Islam. I was a six-year-old child, and he would tell me amazing things. One day he said, "You know what Allahu Akbar means?" And I said, "No." It means God is greater. And I said, what does that mean? And he said, "God is greater than anything you can imagine about God. God is so great that anything you can say or think or imagine about God is nothing compared to the magnificence of God." And that went through me like lightning, to imagine a religion which worships the divine as such an endless, unknowable mystery and magnificence. That was a huge initiation. The second initiation happened when my father took me to the Taj Mahal. I was about seven, And he did it in a very beautiful way. He put his hands over my head as we walked through the archway that opens you to the Taj Mahal. And when we got to the end of the archway, he took his hands off and said, "There it is." And then he told me the story of how it had been built, of how an emperor who had ruled half the world had so loved his wife that he had ransacked the world for all the most beautiful gems, for all the most beautiful materials, to build a tomb that would sanctify and venerate their love forever and ever. And at that moment, I think, I really was drenched with the essential perfume of Sufism, which is the perfume of an abandoned love of the divine. Because what Shah Jahan experienced with Mumtaz Mahal was divine love in a woman. And many years later, I discovered that, in fact, the Taj Mahal was built from a diagram left by Ibn Arabi and discovered a few years ago in a library in Spain. And in this diagram, it shows the unique feature of the Taj, which is that it's at the end of the garden and not in the middle of the garden as so many of the other tombs. And that means that the Taj Mahal, made out of white marble, is not only a monument to Mumtaz Mahal, it is a representation of the majestic throne of the white light, the eternal throne of the white light, that is deep feature of the devotion of Sufi mystics. So I feel that in that moment, when I saw the Taj and was almost and brought to my knees by its beauty and brought to my knees by the beauty of the story, that was the moment in which I first smelled the perfume that I would later smell much more intensely when I met Rumi. And I met Rumi not in India, but in Oxford when I was 25. I had a wonderful tutor who was extremely eccentric, and one day we were talking about Shakespeare's Pericles because I was doing a thesis on Shakespeare and madness, and he said, "Have you ever read the most lucid madman that's ever lived, Jalaluddin Rumi?" And of course I said no, because I hadn't. And he produced a poem and read a poem to me, and I understood absolutely nothing about it because I hadn't begun my mystical journey. But I was so overwhelmed by the glory of the language and the wildness of the language and the intensity of the language and the abandon of the language that something was lodged deep in my soul. And then when I really started to explore Rumi, which happened about 4 years later, through meeting by chance the French translations of a great French translator of Rumi, Eva de Treymeyerovitch, I realized that I had found the Shakespeare of the soul. And then when I went on my own mystical journey, it was always accompanied by Rumi, and I've had many different kinds of relationships with Rumi. The first relationship was aesthetic, loving the splendor and wildness of the language. The second relationship was when I met my own guru, Mother Meera. I planned and decided to try and love her with the kind of intensity that Rumi had loved Shams. And then when I had to leave her, it was Rumi who guided me through the terrible dark night that followed. And since then, it has always been him that I've turned to for the deepest inspiration. Mm-hmm. And what I met in Rumi was the vision of the whole creation being blaze with love, ablaze with divine love, and the whole point of human life to be the living in a love so surrendered and so absolute that you could become one with this love, blazing in and as everything. And that through that love, you, through grace, would be born into a wholly new dimension of divine embodiment. You'd be born to a wholly new kind of human being that in the Islamic tradition is called the Insan Yukamya, the perfected divine human being. And the Islamic mystics believe that the whole creation was created for the birth of a being like this, someone who would see reality with God's own eyes, love reality with God's own love, and serve the whole of reality with God's own humility. And it's this path that has been the most privately intense for me of all the paths. And everything that I've done in all my work, whether it's been about Hinduism or Buddhism or Christianity, has been saturated with the divine passion of this path. And so at this moment in history, I felt it was so important to present, as far as I am able and with all my limitations, a vision of the whole path that the great Sufi mystics offer us to the beloved, because it seems to me that nothing is more important. And it's important for two reasons. The first is to show everyone who is open that Islam is not the barbaric, idiotic, crazy, lunatic, terrorist religion that some of its crazies are representing. It has nothing, the real tradition, to do with that. And Sufism is the ideal way to open up the glory of the real tradition. And the second reason is that at this moment, when so many spiritual seekers are seeking in a rather anorexic and anemic way, the blood-red passion, the fiery passion at the heart of Sufism is, I believe, essential for seekers on any path. Because without that intensity of search, without that intensity of love, without that intensity of passion, the full glory of the mystical path can never open up. So whatever path you are on, I believe the testimony of the great Sufi mystics to the glory of the presence and the enormity of the work that's needed to become one with the presence is now essential for the whole spiritual world, as it has been essential for me.
I mean, it's amazing the power of the truth that's coming through you, and you can feel it's infectious, the passionate intensity. And what is it that, as a practice orientation, since, as you mentioned, there is often kind of an anorexic response to life in spiritual seekers, where there's a withdrawal from life and a wanting to transcend and make the suffering go away in different ways. And so in Sufism that turns people the other way, that leads to such a fiery embrace of life?
Well, let me answer from the heart of the Sufi tradition. For the Sufis, all of reality is sacred. God in Islam has 99 names. Many of them are names of great tenderness and protection and cherishing and nourishing. But Islam's genius is that it faces also the terrifying, the terrible, the avenging sides of God, the disruptive sides of God, sides of God that call for justice. So in the heart of the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, his vision of God was a revelation of God being reality and being the force that transcends reality, but that you cannot get to God except by facing both sides of the divine and responding to both sides and loving both sides and honoring both sides, both the light and the dark. The second great contribution of Sufism has been that you can only come into union with the divine, with this divine that is both Jalal, terrifying, and Jamal, tender, if you abandon yourself in surrender to the reality that is God and learn how to evoke in the depths of your heart through sacred practice an unconditional passion of love for love. And for me, this was a revelation, because I have a very passionate temperament. And although I was deeply attracted to both Hinduism and Buddhism and honor both of them, I could find no place for that wild passion in my heart in either Hinduism or Buddhism. In Sufism, what I found was a very strenuous, very rigorous, but very holy and beautiful system, which allowed me to accept that wild passion as a divine gift and to work with it, to connect it to the great passion at the heart of the Godhead and to purify it so that it become one with the great passion that is also the great peace. So those two aspects of Sufism are, I think, crucial for our time. The other thing that I find very noble about the whole Sufi tradition is that very few of the great Sufi mystics have been ascetics who withdrew from the world. There have been some. Al-Halaj was in many ways one, and so was Rabia. But the majority of the great Sufi mystics lived their lives out in the center of the world. They were fathers and mothers and grandfathers and grandmothers, and they worked at different levels of society, and they worked in the world. So the ultimate ideal of Sufism is not withdrawal from the world, is not selecting what aspect of God that you want to revere. It is accepting the nature of God and the fullness of that nature, terrible and wonderful. It is going on a journey towards becoming love in a body, and it is using that journey in the holiest and highest sense, not to withdraw from the world, but to be a humble channel of God's sacred action in the world, of God's sacred service in the world. And that moved me very much, because so many of the great mystical powers have stressed monasticism and withdrawal, and although they have very noble things to teach us, I don't think that is the path of the great majority of people at this moment. I think for the great majority of contemporary seekers, what we really are looking for is a path that is absolutely clear about the different stages of the path, extremely rigorous in its definitions and discernments, demanding in its truth, but also a path that opens up into a deeper engagement from a calmer and more passionate place with the whole of reality, so as to serve God in reality with all that we are and all that we have. And this, of course, has been part of the formation of my vision of sacred activism.
Wow. I mean, there's so much beauty in what you're sharing. I'm wondering if you can speak a little bit to where has the distortion arisen in some of fundamentalist Islam, because you're talking about this deep, reverent serving of reality and wild, passionate embrace of the world, and yet then you have suicide bombers and terrorists that are invoking Islam in the name of Islam. So I wonder if you can just help us to understand a little bit where this split bifurcation and kind of how it happened in a way too. So that we have this one vision, which is the sacred core and has such truth and beauty, and then we have this modern distortion that is creating really a lot of challenge.
Well, let's not start with Islam, let's start with Christianity. My God, don't we have a very distorted, fanatical vision of Christianity and the fundamentalists? Don't we have
true.
A whole group of Christians who are truly saying theirs is the only path, and this justifies imperialism, this justifies invasion of other countries? We can't just project our shadow endlessly onto Islam. We have to acknowledge that Christianity in its evolution has also evolved a steadily, extremely dangerous shadow.
Mm-hmm.
The truth is that all religions, as we've inherited them, have very great shadows. As I've investigated and lived Buddhism, I've discovered that many Buddhists have a secret sense of superiority of their religion and their way of doing things over others. When you really get to know the Tibetan Buddhists behind closed doors, they talk about the idiocy of all religions that have a vision of God, that God doesn't exist, there's no such thing as a creator God, there is this vast emptiness out of which everything flowers, etc. So there is. And in Hinduism, you have the treatment of women, you have the dowry burnings, you have the caste system. In Christianity, you have this dreadful fanaticism which has justified endless slaughter. And the truth, of course, is that Islam has an immense shadow. And that shadow has really four essential components, as many Islamic mystics are now being willing to say. The first shadow is that Islam has never undergone a reformation, so it's never really looked at the external law that it adheres to, the Sharia, and has never purified that law of all the medieval accretions that are still part of it, and still dangerously part of it. And these accretions are in many ways misogynistic and homophobic to a degree, and also extremely dismissive against the Prophet's own teachings of many, many other forms of religious worship. The second shadow is a result of this adherence to the Sharia and to the absolute belief in Islam that the Quran is not the work of a human being, but the work of God, that it is dictated by God and received by the Prophet Muhammad. This is a very deep problem, because as we are all now discovering, however holy a great text is, however amazing and magnificent the mystical intensity and truth that's burning in it, no text that is in words could ever either express the glory of God or be unstained and uninfluenced by the social and political and economic directions of its time. So Islam has to understand that it cannot go on with this adoration of the text as the ultimate word. It can revere the text, it can honor the text, but not make it the final statement of everything, because that creates the kinds of enormous problems that are now going everywhere. And the central problem in the Quran is this: the verses that were created in Mecca are different from the verses that were created in Medina. When the Prophet was in Medina in the early part of his life is when most of the cosmic teachings came through, the teachings of universal unity with all of life. When he became a ruler, he had to bring order into his world, and he had to speak about many personal, political, social problems, and he spoke brilliantly and with great compassion about all of these. But inevitably, given the century that he was speaking in, there is a great deal of evolution of possibility that's taken place, and Islam is in many ways still closed to that. The third great problem is that there has always been a tension in Islam between those who worship the letter of the Quran, the letter of the Sharia, and those who turned to the secret teachings of the Prophet, which are contained in what is called the Hadiths, the sacred sayings. They're not secret in the sense that they are open for anybody to read, but they are secret because you cannot really understand the grandeur and the splendor of what the Prophet is saying until you have been far advanced through grace on the mystical journey, because the Hadiths are pure instruction of the path to the absolute and the path to embodying the divine in reality through grace. The Sufis chose to work with the Hadiths and the depths of mystery in the Quran, the universal depths of cosmic love in the Quran. The exoteric Islamics have tended to decry the Sufis, sometimes even persecute the Sufis, because they believed the Sufis were in danger of what they call shirk, of idolatry, of claiming incarnation. So there was a tremendous confusion about the real mystical tradition, which was carried on in sometimes impossible situations by the Sufi, a great struggle between that and the official version. The fourth great difficulty is that historical circumstances, and we have a great deal of responsibility for this, I'm talking about the British and the Americans, because of our imperial ambitions, the historical situation has created such resentment, such rage, such humiliation in Islamic countries that it hasn't been the Sufi tradition of universal love that has inspired people, because that demands a level of evolution which is hard when you're being humiliated and broken. What's happened is that people who have experienced the ravages of Western imperialism and the humiliation of being poor and the desperation of cultures struggling for survival have gone to the most regressive interpretations of Islam and have claimed them as the essential ones. So when you bring all of those four things together, you realize that we are dealing with an enormous problem which requires extraordinary tact, extraordinary reverence before the actual revelation, but also the courage to speak up on behalf of a reformation of Islam, to speak up on behalf of a reformation of the vision of women in Islam, to speak up on behalf of a reformation of the vision of homosexuals in Islam, to speak up on behalf of the reformation of the Sharia in Islam, and to speak up most of all on behalf of the tremendous mystical awareness and understanding of the Prophet and the tremendous instruction of the prophet on the authentic mystical path of the beloved that has been a deathless inspiration to all those Sufi mystics who followed it.
Oof. Wow, that was the most amazing explication of that, of those four areas that I've ever heard. That was revelatory, Andrew. Let's go deeper into the transmission itself.
But you take my point that it's not just Islam that is going through
absolutely.
This terrible regression.
Absolutely.
Christianity is. Look at Hinduism. Hinduism has always said there are many paths to God, and you have what is inconceivable. You have Hindu fanatics and nationalists saying that everybody in India has to be Hindu. This goes against the entire preaching of Krishna in the Bhagavad Gita and the entire example of a whole slew of great Hindu saints who have always exemplified tolerance. So it's not only Islam, and it's very important not to endlessly project onto Islam, but to try and understand why Islam is in this crisis and what this crisis is, and to understand or begin to that there is a tender solution to this crisis, which is that all of those who wish to project this madness onto Islam understand the glory of the tradition from the depths of the tradition by really plunging into the hearts of the great mystics who represent the glory of that tradition. And also by representing that glory in such a way that Islam itself takes flame and understands that it cannot go on pursuing this exoteric interpretation, which has so many difficulties and shadows, but must return to the source of its own deepest inspiration to be transformed by that source into what the Prophet always believed and hoped that Islam would be, a great force for unity and peace in the world.
Well, let's dive deeper into that and the specific gifts and blessings, as you've mentioned. So maybe we could, some of these notions that have gotten really warped and perverted, such as it might be interesting to talk about jihad, for instance, and what that really means from the mystical standpoint.
Well, there's a wonderful story about the Prophet which goes straight to the heart of it. The Prophet returned from one of his military expeditions with his guys and said, well, you've been very brave and you fought hard and it was essential that you did, and thank God you did. But this is not the real jihad. This is just the greater jihad. The real jihad, the most difficult battle, is with your false self, and that is the inner jihad. And it's the inner jihad that the Sufi mystics wage on behalf of the beloved. There's a phrase by Al-Halaj, the great Sufi mystic, in which he says, between me and you, there is only me. Take away the me, so only you remain. Those are two of the most astonishing lines ever written by a great mystic. But what they show is that if you are going to go on the path of the beloved, if you're going to commit yourself to love, to being love, then you're going to have to undertake a great battle, a battle with all of the darkness in yourself, with all of the evil in yourself, with all of the shadows of greed and envy in yourself, and that is the true jihad. And one of the agonizing things for somebody who reveres Islam as I do, and who reveres the Sufi tradition as I do, is this idea in the West that the terrorists are representing Islam by talking about the great jihad. The truth of Islam is that the Prophet himself called the inner jihad the essential work, because that's the only work that can clear a human being of everything that prevents him or her from being one with the One.
Beautiful. That really helps to clarify. Also, in this vein, I think it's important for us to really understand what is the deeper relationship of Islam to the divine feminine, particularly in the mystical standpoint, since that's something that's also often gotten distorted.
Well, the key is in the Prophet's own life. And, of course, in the Quran. Let's take the Quran. The opening of the Quran, Bismillahirrahmanirrahim, talks about the Lord of all the worlds who is all compassionate and all merciful. The words for all compassionate and all merciful, Rahman and Rahim, come from the Arabic Rahim, which means womb. So the very first words of the Quran invoke the feminine power, creative, evolutionary, tender, all compassionate, all merciful power of the divine feminine. Allah is neither masculine nor feminine in the deepest sense. Allah has masculine powers and ferocities, but also, and more importantly than anything, because the Quran shows this by making these the opening words of the Quran, Allah is saturated by mercy and compassion, and these are the great feminine virtues. The Prophet himself said there are three great things in life: perfume, prayer, and women. And he had a profound adoration of women. One of the things that few people know is that many of the great sacred sayings, the hadiths, were given in intimate, tender discourse to Aisha, one of his last wives. So what I believe, and many Sufi mystics believe, it was this relationship that the Prophet had of adoration of the Divine Feminine that gave him the mystical clarity and the depth to be able to transmit these holy truths about the essence of the path. The Prophet also said, paradise is at the feet of the mothers. That's a very obscure and strange quote until you realize that what he's saying is that divine reality is manifested through the Rahman, through the Rahim, through the mercy, through the compassion, and that the fullness of divine life, with all of its lushness and glory and passion, is given by the mothers at the heart of the Godhead, by the mother forces. Now let's turn and look at the actual path to the Beloved. There's a wonderful Hindu story which goes to the heart of what I'm going to say, so I hope all of those who are listening who are Sufis and Islamics will forgive this. Mirabai was once trying to enter a Hindu temple, and the Brahmin said, well, you can't enter it because you're a woman and only men can enter this part of the temple. And she said, there is only one man, and that is God. And the rest of us are all female because we have to surrender to God to be filled with God. And naturally, the priest let her in. At the core of the core of the core of the core of the vision of Islam is a vision of a God so unutterably magnificent and so finally mysterious that the only possible response that has any hope of in any way validly expressing from the human side the adoration that is appropriate, the only proper response can only be born through absolute surrender. And what is that but a profound feminine virtue? And when you look at the kinds of virtues that are expected from the lover of the Beloved, the kind of virtues that all of the great Sufi manuals about this great path, that all of the great Sufi poets celebrate, then you realize that these virtues of patience, abandon, capacity for heartbreak, tenderness to all life, and I could go on and on and on, are all virtues of the sacred feminine. They are all virtues that spring from the Rahman and the Rahim. So at the very core of the Quran and the Islamic transmission, and at the very core of the path of the Beloved that springs largely from deep, mysterious truths of the Quran and from the hadiths of the Prophet, at the very core of the whole path and the way in which it trains the lover, is a very profound and comprehensive vision of the sacred feminine. This is something that not all Islamic theologians or even practicing mystics accept, but it's absolutely clear to me and clear to many, many Sufis all over the world that this is the absolute key to the union that's required on the path of the Lovelit, of the names of wrath and the names of tenderness, the great powers of the sacred masculine, the great powers of the sacred feminine, that mirror the union of those in the mystery of the One.
Let's expand the conversation into talking
about... Isn't that exciting, though? It's so exciting.
It's very exciting.
Because
yeah,
Islam itself could catch flame from this, then so many of the tragic divisions that are now plaguing this exoteric and fanatical version of Islam would be healed by the spring of mercy of the sacred feminine that springs from the heart of the Islamic tradition itself. This is part of my dream for the courses, that there will be people from all powers listening and all powers who really want to fire up their own devotion listening and learn about this great system, but also that there should be some Islamic people listening who can truly hear for the first time, perhaps, because they've never had exposed to them how deeply this path is saturated by the mercy and the beauty and the splendor and the love, the great boundless love and compassion of the sacred feminine. This could lead to a revolution. Let's pray and hope in the name of all the great Sufi saints of the Islamic tradition itself. And that revolution would be an immense source of peace in the world.
Really, it could be the key to peace in the world. And I think uncovering these different levels, or rather just opening to these different levels of what you're sharing as this mystical transmission, is so key for all of us. Even if we're a Christian or Hindu or Buddhist, it would just by touching into this level, it helps us dispel some of the surface angst that has come to characterize the relationship of the West and Islam right now.
Absolutely.
So there's another area that we mentioned we would go into, I think it'd be useful to share about, is how, as you're saying, is like Sufism has always been more of a worldly path, in the sense we don't remove ourselves from the world and into ascetic, some sort of ascetic stance, but rather we're fully embedded in the world. So how does this relate to the whole principle of bringing our spiritual ideals into the design of society, and what's the deeper message of Sufism around that?
What the Sufis are saying to us is, you are on earth to become one with the One, and then to serve the will of the One in humility, in servanthood, in the core of reality, with all the gifts and all the resources that God has given you. There could be no clearer message to all of us at this moment. I believe, as you know, that there is only one thing that can now transform our world, and I've called that sacred activism. And for me, as you know, sacred activism is a fusion of the deepest mystical understanding and passion and strength and stamina and peace with a commitment to radical, wise, transformative action in the world. And there are few guides more holy and more passionate and more truthful than the great Sufi mystics to this fusion of the deepest spirituality and the deepest service. They are tremendous guides. So look at Rumi, for example. Rumi didn't withdraw from the world. Rumi didn't, after his immense and terrible and amazing transformation, he didn't go off and live in the mountain. He remained in the center of his world. He remained a father, a grandfather, a teacher, and he poured out all of his amazing poetry in the center of that world. And he gave an example at the center of his world, not only to Islamic people, but also to Jews, to Christians, of what it's like to live a God-possessed, God-driven life. And that was an act of supreme sacred activism, which for a moment ennobled his whole world. If that had been the central ideal for all Muslims to live like that, imagine what this religion could have accomplished at the highest levels in the world.
So, Andrew, what a sort of beautiful vision here, and it really strikes me is that it connects to this notion you shared earlier around the see the sacred in all things, that it is seeing the world with the eyes of the divine, that is really the central move, if you will. So, and to recognize this is a divine playground for us, and that we need to fully open to loving it and taking care of it, and really designing the world as a reflection of the highest in us. So
exactly.
I think that kind of a perspective really, really makes it so accessible to, you know, even if somebody's a practicing Christian, it's like that message is so clear and powerful.
Especially if they're a practical Christian, Stephen, because one of the things that has been totally amazing to me is I've spent, you know, 35 years in the heart of Sufism, being boiled alive in the fires of Sufism, and also plunging into the depths of the Christ path, what I've discovered is that, and this is not my own discovery, I think many people who have taken this journey into both Sufism and Christian mysticism have understood this, what I've discovered is that the path to Christhood and the path to becoming an insan al-kamil, the perfected divine human being, are actually astoundingly the same. They all go through four stages. The path goes through four stages: awakening to the possibility, illumination by the possibility, which ends in the great test, which is called the dark night in Christianity and fana, annihilation in Sufism, which then leads to union, because the false self has been cleared, with the divine beloved, which doesn't end with union, but ends in birthing, ends in becoming a living, humble, tender, indefatigable instrument of God's love in the world. It's exactly the same path. So one of the things that I would really urge everybody out there, so many people have done me the honor of taking the Christ path with me. I would say to you all, if you want even deeper practices sometimes that can help you, if you want another vision of the path that can help you crystallize what you already know about the Christ path, then come on this journey with me into the path of the beloved and find out what I have found out, how these two paths are subtly different but profoundly linked statements of the same understanding of the glory and rigors and difficulties and amazing possibilities of transformation from a human being into a conscious divine human being that is one with the One.
I also want to encourage you to share about one other aspect of the Sufi quest, it really considers itself a more universal path. That it's not you don't have to pledge loyalty to Islamic faith. It's Sufism has wound its way through the heart of many different traditions around the world, and it is deeply committed to this more universal understanding as well.
Well, this is very thorny territory, and I'd like to make a few distinctions to help everybody. The first truth is that there are many Sufis who believe that you can only be a Sufi in Islam by taking the subtle, deep, mysterious route that I've tried to describe. So there are Sufis who believe that Sufism springs straight from the Quran and from the Hadith, and that there isn't authentic Sufism without that. There are also, and these are the Sufis that I have found more universally congenial, there are also the Sufis who believe that once you have the experience of the beloved in everything and as every human being and as every stone and as every animal, the traditional religious distinctions vanish and you are in a completely new dimension, which is the dimension of universal love. Recently, I've come to understand that actually the two are not as different as you might assume, because many of the Sufis who believe that you can only take the path in Islam have come through their practice to have a vision of universal cosmic love, which they put into practice in the deepest part of their lives. And many of the ones who have taken a more universal Sufi path have not been as rigorous and as devoted and as disciplined as those who have taken the more dogmatic path. So the complications are endless, but what I believe is that if you truly honor the tradition, as I'm hoping to do in the transmissions I give, I'm starting by honoring the mystical transmission in the Quran, the mystical transmission in the Hadiths, and the mystical transmission about the understanding of the path found in those Sufis who truly honored that tradition. I'm starting there because I want people to really get that it is possible within the confines, if you like, of Islam, to be sprung free of those confines and to connect with what I would call the universal Islam of the heart. The heart, in its universal aspect, that the Prophet, peace be upon him, was one with. Then I plunge into those mystics whom I believe have the most ability and power to speak to people on all paths. I hope I've made my distinctions clear for you.
That was beautifully clear, and I think this is actually a perfect moment to direct folks who are listening to the upcoming program, and it's called The Sufi Way of the Beloved, Opening to Ecstasy, Fearlessness, and Compassion Through the Wisdom of Seven Great Mystics. And first of all, we're so delighted that Andrew has decided to work with us on this program and offer it through our whole extended network because of all of what was shared today is revelatory, and often it reveals a lot of our unconscious biases or places that we haven't been as open to this lineage and the beauty and power and blessing of it. So it's a real spiritual initiation, but it's also a cultural initiation, and helps to expand our paradigm of understanding all of these different beautiful lineages we've inherited. So you can find the program at SufiWayCourse.com. That's S-U-F-I Way, W-A-Y, course.com, SufiWayCourse. And it's going to be a seven-week journey with Andrew. And as you can tell from today, Andrew is amazingly impassioned and powerful. It's a real transmission of energy and consciousness and thought form and practice. Every module is a potent alchemical
It's a nuclear bomb every module.
It's a little nuclear bomb. Little
radioactive.
So you need the week.
I have selected the greatest of the testimonies of the lovers to try and bring in the vast intensity of this vision and the precision of this vision. It will dazzle you when you see it and when you really understand it or begin to understand it. It is so extraordinary what the Sufi mystics have given us. And it's so essential for our spiritual path now, because what they give us most of all is permission to choose the passionate way to God, to burn with passion for the beloved. And I think that that is a permission that so many seekers have yet not given themselves. And I hope that the Sufis that I present to you will give you that permission as they have given me that permission. Because if you hear energy and excitement in my voice, it's because my whole being has been lit by the mystics that I'm going to try with all my limitations to present for you.
Well, it's also in our new consciousness, new paradigm kind of circles that passion has often been squelched in favor of a kind of cool aloofness. And so I think what you're pointing out to is this is really an important gateway initiation for all of us, regardless of what path we are on, to really open these qualities and these attributes of the passionate mystical life. So let's go, actually take a little tour of the modules. Again, you can find them in depth at SufiWayCourse.com. And the first module is on the Sufi vision of the way of the beloved. You want to share a bit about that, Andrew?
What I'm going to try and do in this module is to open up some of the mystical depths of the Quran. Rumi and Shams both said in different ways that there are seven major veils veiling the essential truths of the Quran. You can read it exoterically, but you have to have gone through a tremendous journey to be able to find the really luminous and universal truths that are hidden in it, that are blazing at the heart of it. And I'm going to select passages that will reveal the universal heart of the Quran. Then I'm going to concentrate on five of the Prophet's major mystical sayings from the Hadith, because when you really hear what the Prophet is giving us in these hadiths, which is nothing less than a universal vision of the relationship of the human and the divine, and a path to that realization of that vision and a description of what happens to a human being when he or she becomes infused by God, you will, as I was when I first discovered the Hadith, be brought to your knees. The Hadiths are for every practicing mystic on whatever path one of the most potent and most extraordinary documents ever given humanity. And then I'm going to end that transmission by offering a four-part vision of the path, which I've already sketched. There are many different versions of the path in Sufi mystics. Some are seven parts, some are nine parts, you can imagine. There'll be many different formulations. But what I've discovered through the help of my Sufi teachers and through the help of my ultimate Sheikh Shams is that there are really four essential stages, and I will share that vision of how you come to be one with the One and how you come to recognize yourself in amazement and with great humility as the beloved of the beloved, and how you come to be born through the immense grace and the terrible and amazing alchemy of these four stages into being a human being who sees with the eyes of God and loves with the heart of God and serves with the humility and servant of God in reality. So that's the first module. And I really want this to be a marvelously powerful introduction to everything, because I want anyone who listens to it to forever end their prejudices about the Quran and the Prophet, and to realize that what we're dealing with in the Quran and in the sacred sayings of the Prophet are some of the most amazing revelations of the human relationship with the divine that has ever been given humanity. Revelations that have not permeated Islam as deeply as they should have done, just as the revelations that Jesus gave have not permeated Christianity as deeply as they should have done. Let's get over our horror of how things have evolved and go back to the source and the origin and the original inspiration and see how amazing it was and become empowered by it.
Beautiful. Well, let's wrap, take a quicker tour through the other modules, but the second is on two martyrs of love, on Al-Halaj and Rabia.
Well, I thought that after the Quran and the Hadiths of the Prophet, we should plunge into the cauldron of fire with two of the ultimately great mystics of Sufism, at the core of the evolution of Sufism. Al-Halaj was hung, drawn, and quartered in the main square in Baghdad in the early 10th century for crying out, An al-Haq, I am the supreme reality, testifying to the miracle of human union at deep levels with the divine. And when his body was shattered and broken, it said that it fell in the letters, An al-Haq, proclaiming even in his dereliction the truth of what he had testified. And that freaked everybody out so much that they burned his body and threw the ashes of his body on the Euphrates, and on the river itself, the ashes in letters of burning fire spelled out, An al-Haq, I am the supreme reality. And although Sufis in the coming centuries differed as to what Al-Halaj had actually done. Some people said he should never have said this, it's a secret which shouldn't be announced. Some people said that he was crazy, he was speaking blasphemously. And some people, like Rumi and Shams, said, no, he wasn't speaking at all. God was speaking through him. The point about Al-Halaj, and I'm only just beginning to sketch how important he is for the Sufis, is that he was the first in the tradition to burn with the central sacred revelation at the heart of all mystical traditions and at the heart of this one. But at the end of the journey, what we all discover is that we are one with supreme reality, the beloved of it, and the representative of it. Rabia was a woman, and she lived in the 10th century. She had a very difficult early life, and she withdrew into a room later on and meditated absolutely with her whole being on the One. And she wrote a handful of poems which are amongst the most sublime poems ever written by a human being. Even more importantly, and this is so thrilling, she was the first person in the Islamic tradition to proclaim God as beloved. And in proclaiming God as beloved, in honoring and loving God as beloved, what she opened up, and I'm certain this was because she had this profound gift of the sacred feminine within her heart, what she opened up was a path that could channel and bring together all the powers of love and concentrate them all on the beloved. And this, of course, led to the whole renaissance of Sufi mystical poetry that went on from the 11th to the 15th century, from Sana'i to Attar to Rumi to the great Shabastari to, of course, the one I've selected, Darashikoh, and revealed a wholly new way of relating to God, which is, I think, for me at least, the most potent, the most wonderful way of relating to God. God is beloved. So those two martyrs of love really, in their different ways, show different but very deeply related way, show the intensity, the passion, the adoration of the authentic path, and forever mark the whole Sufi revelation.
It's amazing what you're sharing about these different mystics, and we're not going to have time to go into each module at this level of depth, so I'll just hit a few highlights and you can chime in. So in module 3, we're going to go into the glory of the glory, Ibn Arabi, who's a great Sufi mystic as well.
It's absolutely amazing to think that I could even begin to transmit anything serious about the greatest philosopher, sheikh of Islam, Ibn Arabi, in an hour, but I will try. Ibn Arabi is quite simply one of the greatest philosophical mystics who's ever lived, a being on the height of Aurobindo, or Meister Eckhart, someone who explored the relationship to God from every conceivable angle. He was unutterably brilliant, and he left a philosophical system which reveres the whole of reality as the beloved and teaches us how to approach the beloved through all the different aspects of our being. And I will hope to give you just a taste of why he is so astonishing.
We then go into module 4, Radiant Bewilderment as the Gate to Oneness, and that's Attar, also from ancient Persia, correct?
Attar lived in Nishapur in northern Iran. He had a little chemist shop, and he was perhaps the greatest writer of a long mystical poem the world has ever seen. He wrote a poem called Conference of the Birds, which for my money is the greatest long mystical poem ever written. And in this poem, he describes a group of birds who set off to find the great bird and go through 7 different valleys, each one that corresponds to different stages of the path, and finally end absolutely desperate and bedraggled at the threshold of the king, and in ways that I will describe to you are then taken into the revelation of what Al-Halaj discovered. There is no greater text, and Attar is said to have met Rumi as a young boy and has said to him, this boy will open a new gate in the walls of love. So Attar is a very crucial figure, a very great poet, and a very great master of the whole evolution of the path to the beloved. And I will attempt to show you just how profound his vision is.
Module 5, we go into the Way of Passion with Rumi, and we don't need to go into that now because we've heard a lot about Rumi, but you're going to open up whole new vistas of understanding there. And then also in Module 6, we go into his real kind of soul partner in many ways, Shams, who called forth Rumi's realization and was a source of great challenge and inspiration, initiation, and heartbreak as well. So there was... That's on the Way of Fierce Truth, an invocation of the transforming presence of Shams. And finally, Module 7 is a Sufi vision for the world. So it's a very comprehensive look at the whole lineage of Sufism, and I think it's going to be particularly powerful to look through the lens of these seven different mystics, each of whom really has powerful, poignant life experiences that are illuminating for our own path. So a bit more about the whole program. First of all, it's going to start on June 28th, so just a few weeks. You get access not only to the class sessions with Andrew, you have live interactive calls and Q&A time. Andrew is quite amazing when you just ask spontaneous questions, so it's really precious to have that opportunity. You also have a Facebook group where it allows you to go deeper. You get recordings of every class session and PDF transcripts, and the PDF transcripts are particularly important since Andrew is a fire hose of inspiration, and so it's hard to get all the notes down, and so if you actually get all the words for the future, it's quite a blessing. We also have a number of great extra bonuses. So we have one with Banafshe Sayad, who is a beautiful dancer called In the Fire of Grace, and she's really...
And a very great teacher of the sacred feminine. There's nobody on the planet who understands both the shadow of Islam and the glory of Islam more deeply than this amazing woman who has chosen to remain deeply indebted to Islam and a true Sufi. She is an amazing being, and I made a film with her called Fire of Grace, and the dialogue that we've just recorded for you is, I think, revelatory, and especially revelatory about the presence of the sacred feminine within Sufism. Mm.
Yes. So that dialogue is called Dancing as the Beloved of the Beloved. So that's another bonus. We also have brought in two sessions from a full other 10-week program that Andrew offered on Rumi and the Way of Passion, Igniting the Divine Fire in Your Heart. So you're getting some of the best of that course. And we have another dialogue that's also part of the program with Charles Upton called The Path to the Beloved. And you want
many
to
of you won't know who Charles Upton is, but that's a great misfortune, because Charles Upton, for my money, is the greatest living Islamic mystic. He's somebody who has plunged into the heart of Islam after many, many different voyages in other disciplines, and who writes about the Sufi path with breathtaking elegance and breathtaking passion and precision. I'm a deep admirer of his, and I'm so grateful to have the opportunity of offering his wisdom to you, because, to put it quite honestly, his writings have transformed my life and have transformed my understanding of the depths of the Sufi path from the Quranic tradition. It's not that Charles is hostile to other interpretations of Sufism, it's that he's plunged into the Quranic core and really lived it. So his testimony is, I think, inestimably important. So I chose two different people, one who has gone the more universal path that Banafshe has gone, and one who has plunged into the rigor and splendor of the real Quranic Sufi Hadith path, and who is a matchless interpreter of it. So you can have both sides.
We also have two bonuses that are available when you register by Saturday, when you register by the end of tonight, by midnight tonight. So we like to do this as an extra incentive when you go to the page now at SufiWayCourse.com, SufiWayCourse.com, that you have an extra incentive to sign up right away, and that helps us plan, and it also just helps to activate the whole program in your consciousness. So this is two recordings. One is called The Eternal Wine, Poems of Rumi for Our Time, and the other is The Perfume of the Desert, two beautiful audio recordings from Andrew that really add value and poetry and nuance and depth to this whole revelation that the Sufi...
The Perfume of the Desert is a two-CD recording of the ones I consider to be the real heralds of this Sufi revelation of the path to the beloved. So it's a complete exploration of the whole path as spoken through the words of Sufi mystics from the 8th century to the 19th century. So it's as if you're sitting there and receiving the whole transmission through the words of those who truly know the reality of it.
Well, what a beautiful offering. So it's... As I've said before, I think this should be a required initiation and gateway for all of us to pass through, so that we complete our own mystical training and also learn to embrace the great beauty and blessing of Islam through the heart of Sufism. So it starts on June 28th. It's going to be on Tuesdays at 5 p.m. Pacific time. We've kept the price very accessible, just three payments of $109, or you save 10% at $297 when you pay in full. And you have the extra two audio recordings from Andrew when you sign up by the end of today, by midnight Pacific time, giving you a little extra incentive to go in, go to the page, tune in, and if you feel the electricity and the fire on coming through Andrew's voice and sense the importance of this revelation for your own spiritual development, that you have an extra gift for doing so when you sign up today. So again, you can find all the details at SufiWayCourse.com, and I can assure you that Andrew is always thrilling and he's always dedicated to really serving the students' needs in the programs and really giving you the straight truth and unadulterated truth that really can help liberate you and open your eyes, heart, and soul to new possibilities. It's a great blessing, Andrew. So anything as you as we're coming to a close here that you want to share to final thoughts
to
those?
Prayer of Ibn Arabi's, if you didn't mind. I would love to read this prayer because this is, for me, the prayer at the heart of the universal Sufi tradition, the universal path to the beloved. And this is the prayer of a very great Muslim, someone who adored the Prophet, adored the Quran, and who had a universal realization which opened him to all paths, to the truths hidden in all paths. And it goes like this. O garden amidst the flames, my heart has become capable of every form. It is a pasture for gazelles, and a monastery for Christian monks, and a temple for idols, and the pilgrim's Kaaba, and the tablets of the Torah, and the book of the Quran. I follow the religion of love. Whatever way love's camel takes, that is my religion, my faith. That
Beautiful.
Is the greatest prayer of universal mysticism that I know, and it comes from the heart of the Sufi tradition. And if you want to know the truth of that prayer as revealed by the heart of the Sufi tradition, please come on this great adventure with me.
Well, thank you, Andrew, and thank you all for joining here today. I encourage you to really go for this exquisite opportunity to learn from such a blessed teacher and such a powerful lineage, and really open your heart and soul to the next phase of your own unfolding and divine embodiment. So again, you can find all the details about Andrew's upcoming program at SufiWayCourse.com. And I just want to thank you also for joining here today in such a beautiful state of learning and opening and love. So thank you all, and thank you, Andrew. Goodbye now.
Thank you so much, Stephen.